Hey, all, and welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. It's your fearless host, Travis, and I am going to talk about something that is a doozy today. I have got a nice beverage to share with you the worst case scenario for the Save and Plan lawsuits and what it means for you. So this worst case scenario, I think, is best described as the following. Imagine a world where the Save Plan gets struck down. By striking it down, they also strike down a lot of the ICR statute, which stops them from doing the repay plan, stops them from doing the pay plan, and then makes it so that only people can sign up for IBR. So if that were to occur, that worst case scenario would probably also involve hundreds of thousands of borrowers that could have gotten public service loan forgiveness and private sector loan forgiveness that will be blocked from it because of the rules of IBR surrounding partial financial hardships and being eligible to sign up for that plan. So let me explain what I mean by that, because that's a pretty scary thing. And let me tell you that this is not what I'm predicting. This is what I am letting you know is a worst case scenario. I'm saying this so that you can know that there's a lot of strategies and loopholes and things you can do to protect yourself against this worst case scenario. And it's something that we're going to be actively thinking about at SLP to try to protect our community, our clients, our financial planning clients, consult clients, etc., tax clients, of course, as well. Again, what is this worst case scenario? How do we arrive at it? So the worst case scenario is the Save Plan lawsuits. They are targeting the Save Plan, and the way they're trying to do this is the kitchen sink. The ICR statute is the law that was used to create the Save Plan. The ICR statute says Secretary of Education can make a IDR plan that is up to 20% of income, up to 25 years until forgiveness. And the Save Plan, being way more generous than that, technically does fit into that allowable range. So the people suing over this plan are thinking, well, maybe if we take down the ICR statute, it'll take out the Save Plan, it'll take out everything that we don't like. And maybe it even takes out more than the Save Plan. And will they have a problem with that? Probably not. So the worst case scenario is that the Eighth Circuit makes this really extreme ruling. It gets appealed to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court's like, Congress didn't intend all this with the ICR statute. So, you know, the only option that's allowed is ICR for Parent Plus borrowers and IBR for everybody else. If that were the case, I want you guys to think for a moment about the current state of student loans and what everybody's payments are really based on. Because if you really think about it, you're either a borrower that's graduated since the pandemic started, in which case you applied with maybe more recent income, or you're a borrower that had a payment from before the pandemic, and that payment has been very low for a very long time based on a very low tax return from years ago. So think about this. Most people, when the pandemic started, were certified with their IDR plan on a 2018 tax return. I have no idea what I made in 2018. Do you? I don't remember. I remember maybe ballpark, but it was just like, that's a long time ago. And so if you think about 2018 tax returns that people are certified with IDR on, what's happened is a lot of folks were involuntarily switched to the Save Plan or voluntarily. And then with the Save Plan payments, a lot of people, 9 million people, are put into the Save Plan forbearance. And so if that plan was struck down, everybody would have to apply for a new plan. Everybody would have to recertify their income to a new plan. And the only plan in this worst case scenario environment could be IBR. And so if that's the case, if it really is IBR and that's it, then people would not be able to potentially sign up. So if people needed to sign up for IBR en masse, they would have to do so with a more recent income. And how recent would that income be? 2024 tax returns for the most part. So if we had 9 million people that were enrolled in the Save Plan that suddenly need to switch off of it and sign up for IBR, do you have a partial financial hardship? If you don't have a partial financial hardship, you do not qualify. And partial financial hardship does not mean that you're experiencing hardship. It's actually a very technical definition. What it means is that your calculated payment on the IBR plan, either old IBR or new IBR, is below the standard 10-year plan amount. So for example, if you have $200,000 of loans, a rough rule to say is 1% of your balance is the standard 10-year plan. So if you have $200,000 of loans, 1% of that's $2,000 a month. So that would be roughly your standard 10-year payment. And for you to sign up for the IBR plan, your required payment would have to be below that under IBR. So you'd have to have any IBR payment, as long as it's below $2,000 a month, that would qualify you to switch on to IBR. And the real problem here is, let's say you're a resident physician, and let's say you've done your training and you're now an attending physician, but your income is still based off of back when you were resident. Well, if your income, let's say, is $250,000 and you have $150,000 in medical school loans and you were in the SAVE plan forbearance, then if you go to sign up for IBR because everything gets struck down by the courts, you will not have a partial financial hardship because your calculated IBR payment in that case would be higher than the standard 10-year plan. And if they block ICR, which these new regulations did, and they also block pay and reap, you know, all these other things, then in a world where Republicans win these lawsuits in a big way and Democrats tighten down access to a lot of these other plans with new regulations, and IBR is the only option, there are people with 8 years of PSLF credit in this scenario that potentially might not be able to sign up for PSLF at the very end because you have to have 10 years worth of qualifying payments. So if you cannot physically sign up for an income-driven repayment amount at all because you're not eligible for IBR because you don't have a partial financial hardship, you could be at year 8 or even year 9 of PSLF and have no way to get to year 10 to cross the finish line. Some people listening to this might be alarmed now, and that's not my intent. I want to make it clear that this is not something that has come to pass or that I'm actually probably even expecting to pass, but it is a possibility, and I thought it would be worthwhile to do a podcast on the possibility that this could occur so that people are thinking about it. What would you do in that scenario, in this like doomsday scenario where a lot of people that were able to get forgiveness are not even able to get forgiveness at all anymore? What you would have to do is be super intentional about what tax return am I going to use to apply and when? What is my taxable income and how am I going to use that income? Am I filing taxes, married filing jointly or married filing separately? Do I do AGI reduction to the maximum extent possible? Do I make sure that I've got the income split the right way if I'm in a community property state when I've got all these really crazy complexities that come along with that, you know, such as Schedule C splitting or, you know, investment splitting, or that you're taking advantage of really complex write-offs like QBI deduction, qualified business income if you're an S corporation, if you are a professional, if you're doing an S corporation, are you staying below the threshold for specified trade and service business? I don't need to get into all of that, but what I'm saying is that the 2024 tax year is going to be critical, absolutely critical, because if in this worst case scenario that this occurs where stuff gets repealed, if you planned ahead and filed your taxes separately, kept your AGI as low as possible with solo 401ks or 401ks or 403bs or whatever pre-tax stuff that you can do to make sure that you've got that partial financial hardship just in case so that you could qualify to sign up for the IBR plan just in case, that's literally preserving your opportunity to get forgiveness instead of not get forgiveness. And that is really critical for a physician or a dentist or, you know, a lawyer, somebody like that who's so close to loan forgiveness yet could be so far away. And so I just am thinking about this more and more lately because there's two scenarios, right? Trump wins or Kamala Harris wins the presidency. And then if, you know, depending on those scenarios, if Trump wins and there's an extreme Eighth Circuit ruling, they might just let it stand, which could cause this worst case scenario to happen, because they don't appeal it to the Supreme Court, which I know y'all might think that's crazy to say that that would be, the Supreme Court would be not the same, but they actually might not. And the reason for that is the Eighth Circuit has one Democratic justice out of, a Democratic appointed justice, I should say, out of like 10 or 11 judges total. And then the Supreme Court has three and then six Republican appointed justices total. So it just, the balance of who appointed what judge is even more Republican leaning in the Eighth Circuit than it is on the Supreme Court. And so for that reason, actually, if you had a Kamala Harris win and she would, of course, appeal any adverse ruling from the Eighth Circuit to the Supreme Court, what would actually occur is they might take a more moderate position that would still maybe strike down the SAVE plan, but it would probably allow maybe some pre-COVID type of plans to exist, I would think, something like pay or repay, maybe unblock the ICR plan. And that would give us a lot more tools to work with people whose income is above the cap so that they would still be able to get forgiveness. You know, in terms of all these different scenarios, one thing that would be interesting is if something like this were to occur, one reason why I'm not extremely worried about this scenario is this is a scenario where I actually very much believe that Congress would be forced to act to do something, right? So if you think about the power of something like American Medical Association or those sorts of lobbies, they got Kaiser Permanente completely reclassified as a qualifying PSLF employer purely through lobbying efforts, you know, combination of AMA, California Association of Hospitals, et cetera, right? So like there's power there. And if a lot of physicians had PSLF yanked away from them in year nine because of something like this, I guarantee you there would be a massive effort to pass some sort of rule in Congress to maybe make the repay plan an option, which repay would be great because you do not have to have a partial financial hardship to apply for repay. It's just 10% of your income, period. And so if you're slightly above the cap, it doesn't matter. You're still qualifying for an IDR plan. So you could still get actual payment credit towards whatever 10-year payment count you would need, or, you know, 20 or 25-year payment count if you're going for private sector forgiveness. How would this whole thing potentially affect the math of forgiveness in the first place? People would still mostly go for forgiveness if you have debt that's larger than your income. And in some cases, even if the debt's smaller than your income, you would still be able to go for forgiveness, even if all this stuff was repealed and the worst case scenario happened. And the reason for that is the IBR plan is basically the same thing as pay if you borrowed after 2014 for the first time. And so when you look at that pay plan, it's very generous. It is something that makes it a no-brainer to go for forgiveness for the most part if your income is lower than your debt amount. And you would just need to do the same sorts of things that we do now for folks, which is help figure out the married filing separate decision, help look at the pros and cons of that, loan savings versus higher tax costs potentially. We just got done with our first full tax season, and we learned a whole lot from that tax season. So one thing that's kind of interesting is some people filing separately have huge costs associated with it, and some people filing separately don't have huge costs associated with it. Also, we had some cases where people did some TurboTax work that our team checked, and we found errors as large as like $15,000 of extra taxes people paid because they did their own taxes in TurboTax. This is often usually because of the community property splits. People living in community property splits sometimes don't do that split correctly, and it costs people four or five figures in extra taxes because you're supposed to file Form 8958 and split the income, and people don't do it. I think we learned a whole lot about just how important taxes are going to be and tax strategy is going to be for the future of student loans. So if we really think about what loopholes are available, the government really, really wants to move the student loan system to more and more and more of an income tax. And when you do that, it makes your tax return and your tax strategies critical and super important. So things like, should you file an extension for your taxes? Should you file separately? How do you reduce your AGI? You know, one thing that's wild to me is, and this is something that we do with IDR sensitive portfolios construction, is people don't think about the impact that student loan borrowers' marginal tax rate has on investment returns and how much you should work. So in surveys we've done, burnout is a massive problem among people in our audience. People are stressed out. They are tired. A lot of surveys we see, for example, show that people are expecting to work a lot fewer hours than they actually end up working post-graduation because of increased demands on especially medical professions. And that's leading to a lot of life satisfaction issues and work satisfaction issues. And I think that if people knew what they're actually earning for that last shift you take at the hospital, fewer people would work as much as they do. And the reason for that is you've got federal, state, local in some cases, Social Security, Medicare, FICA basically, and then any other miscellaneous taxes, and then also 10% for IDR if you're on pay or, you know, save or the new IBR, or 15 if you're on old IBR, which is anybody in this worst case scenario planning would be anybody for their first loan before 2014. So that's pretty much anybody in their mid-20s or beyond probably would be on that old version of IBR. And so if you think about this in terms of a marginal tax rate, if the old IBR plan was the only game in town, you know, you might have 15% IBR, 32% federal. So let's see if I can do math. That's 47. And then, you know, 7.5 FICA. So that's like 55. And then throw on like state. So let's say it's 5 at 60%, maybe 65% if you're in California. So we're up to people paying 60 to 65% of that marginal dollar they're earning because of the high rate of that student loan borrowers get hit with taxes. That's massive, right? So in other words, if you just like made a more frugal choice on your vehicle, you could probably afford to work 4 days a week instead of 5 days a week and be financially the exact same. This is like for somebody making, you know, like 120K type of income versus somebody obviously making way, way more than that. Wouldn't be the same math. And you'd maybe be in a lower tax rate, blah, 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 right? The general idea is pretty accurate that people are not paying attention to their marginal tax rates and the decisions that that could have, the impact that should have on your decisions of how much you should work. People aren't thinking about how to reduce their AGI enough. I think people are kind of just setting it on autopilot and making a lot of mistakes there. And I think people are making a ton of mistakes with how they file their taxes. That's certainly something that we've seen from our first year starting a tax business. We just finished up this first full tax year, which ends, you know, basically October 15th is the extension deadline. So that's why I'm saying that. And I think that just tax strategy in general is just absolutely critical. It's absolutely critical. So whether you're getting kind of like the high level from like a student loan planner consult, or you're going into more like tax planning with like an SLP wealth financial planner, or you're getting into like the how do I do this and do it for me kind of conversations that we have with the SLP wealth tax team, I really hope you pay attention to your 2024 taxes. And just, you know, since we're not done with the 2024 calendar year yet, what kind of pre-tax contributions can you be making or maximizing? Or, you know, a lot of times if you're way behind on your 401k, you can make your next four paychecks or two paychecks, like 100% of your paycheck going to your 401k with the payroll withholding change to make sure you get to the max on that paycheck. The reason is just because the AGI stuff's going to matter. It's going to be critically important because, like I said, if in this worst case scenario where courts strike down absolutely everything but IBR, which is possible, it's more probable with the Trump victory than it is with the Harris victory, but it's still possible with the Harris victory too. So if this were to occur, if they repeal absolutely everything but the IBR plan, you want to make sure you can still get onto that plan, meaning filing separately for taxes if you need to, minimizing AGI, looking into whether or not you should file for an extension so that you can use a tax return that's a lower income for a longer period of time. There's all kinds of stuff to be paying attention to during this time. So that was the worst case scenario. I probably could do the best case scenario in a very short episode. Basically, the best case scenario would be save is untouched, which shocks the world, and a lot more people, millions more people can get forgiveness, and nurses and MAs and lower paid workers, right, teaching assistants could actually get PSLF for a change, which is like kind of ridiculous to think about this program that was made for public servants. And they always talk about, you know, when they're ever talking about PSLF, they always talk about like teachers, firefighters. But the formula pre-save plan makes it so hard for those folks to get forgiveness because, you know, if you have a modest amount of debt, you tend to just pay that off in full anyway because your balance is so small. It's just like even a small payment would pay the loan off with the formula that they use that was pre-save plan, which is why they tried to make it more generous to help more people get forgiveness. Same thing for private sector forgiveness. You know, they tried to make it so that people could get forgiveness much faster than 20 years if they have very small balances. So if you have a very small balance, you could get it in as little as 10 years for until forgiveness. So if I was going to take the middle of the road approach to what I think will happen, not the worst case scenario, I think that maybe the middle approach, and which would be kind of a middle positive approach, would be that they get rid of the 10-year forgiveness, they get rid of the 5% of income for undergrads, but they keep everything else with the save plan. That's actually possible. I actually think that maybe would be the most likely outcome with a Harris victory plus it going to the Supreme Court and them ruling on that. That would be the thought process there, is maybe that would occur with the current iteration of the Supreme Court if Harris were to win, but it's really hard to say. So we will know more in the coming weeks. Obviously, the election is going to be really important to know who wins so we can go into the scenario planning for that. And what the Eighth Circuit wants to do with all these rulings is going to set the tone for how the Supreme Court rules, probably, because they're going to at least look into the reasoning the Eighth Circuit used and how they make their decision, probably. So that's another thing we'll be following super closely. But remember that the worst case scenario can be protected against somewhat by really good advance planning, especially tax planning, which is why we started a tax business, as painful as it's been. I'm going to tell you that I never, ever wanted to do or start a tax business because it's a lot of work, you know, and I'm not a CPA. So going through the difficult part of just starting a tax business, why did we do it? It's because I knew we needed it. I knew we needed to have this so that we could learn a ton of the actual nuts and bolts of how do you actually turn the widgets in the right direction and position to get it locked in place to get the savings that we need to get for people, because it's going to be absolutely going to battle for borrowers if this worst case scenario occurs. Because I've got some other loophole ideas we could use to combat even the situation where somebody doesn't have a partial financial hardships. For example, how would you like to go to your boss and say, I need to take an unpaid 1 month leave of absence so that I can go and contact my IDR application, go do that and say, I no longer have a taxable income, which would technically be true for that month. And then you could sign up for IBR with a $0 a month payment. And then the next time you certify your IBR payment, your payment would get capped at the standard 10-year amount, but at least you would have gotten back onto the IBR plan. So I've got a lot of strategies for if we do have to deal with the worst case scenario that we will absolutely go to battle over and help you implement. But obviously there's a lot of easier strategies like filing extensions, filing separately, amendments, community property splitting, 8958. Paying attention to your AGI, maximizing all available pre-tax accounts, maxing solo 401ks if you're a business owner, setting up one, which is a big problem. A lot of business owners haven't even set one up before. Not over-contributing to Roth accounts when you really should be looking at pre-tax, HSAs, dependent care FSAs if you got kids in daycare. I could go on and on, right? I'm getting worked up, guys. I'm getting excited. So many savings that people are not thinking about. That's one reason I love doing this and why I've done it for 8 years is because usually it's like, you see something and it's usually always somebody's missing at least one thing that could be a game changer, right? There's usually always at least one massive opportunity that people are just not thinking about that can save them a boatload of money if you're a student loan borrower. So that's what's kept this fun and interesting for me. And thank you for being interested in this because you could be listening to true crime right now. And instead, you're listening to the nuclear apocalypse of student loans. So I hope I've made it as entertaining as I possibly can be for you. If you need a consult, go to studentloanplanner.com/book. And if we have space available in our tax business, we will share that information with folks on the email list in the future in the upcoming weeks. So thank you guys for listening to the Student Loan Planner podcast.